told you last night to get this little book out. Now, I hope you took it to bed with you, haven't took it out of your hand since last night, so we can get on with it. We have been, for more than a year and a half, hammering at a truth that needs to be recognized. Wherever God capsulizes or puts in a container or places or focuses a truth, however you want to say it, if it's a truth of great importance in God's master plan, you can be very sure that the prince of the power of the air, the arch enemy of God, is going to move on the scene and caricature it. A lot of people do not really understand that Antichrist comes in as a substitute Christ, a substitute deliverer. All prophecy of Scripture is contained in that opening statement where God says, "The seed of the woman shall bruise the head of the serpent, and the serpent in turn shall have his head bruised by the seed of the woman." Satan set out immediately to put his substitute in its place and bend that truth out of shape. It became a battleground of truth territory to be seized by Satan, taken from God, and changed into a different image that Satan wanted. Just about every major heathen religion had its birth in Babylon. Not the Babylon of Nebuchadnezzar, but that ancient original Babylon that Nimrod, whose name means rebel, who formed the first kingdom and set himself up in opposition to God and would literally ascend to heaven with the Tower of Babel, the Plain of Shinar, that Babylon. Out of that same place came the birth of faith in Abraham. But the wife of Nimrod was still living when Abraham left Ur of the Chaldees. Nimrod, setting himself up as substitute king, the first earthly kingdom, and marrying that witch, Semiramis, became God, or the devil's agent, to try to get the jump on God in a contest for a territory of truth. Semiramis, as you've heard us teach so many times, after the death of Nimrod, claimed that a son that was conceived to cover her immorality was conceived by the sun, conceived by a sunbeam, and that Nimrod had become the sun, and her son Tammuz was but the reincarnation of Nimrod, conceived by a sunbeam. And out of that birth idea came Satan's caricature of the mother and child concept, elevating the mother above the child, the seedbed of all the heathen religions that spread across the land, ultimately through Pergamos and Alexandria in Egypt, to come and conquer Rome before the church got there, and so keep the pressure on the Roman church when Constantine Christianized the empire, that more of its elements adorn the church today than the biblical elements. But that was Satan's fight and attempt to seize the truth that the seed of a woman, God incarnate, kinsman redeemer, would move on to this earth scene and bring God's answer to the problems here, ultimately conquering that old serpent. Satan was present at the councils of God when the plan was conceived, and Satan, or rather Jesus, offered himself, to use Paul's words, as the lamb slain from the foundation of the world. He knew God's plan. He bided his time and waited the opportunity to twist it out of shape. And like taking a focus meter and twisting it a little, it'll contain germs of truth, analogous truth, but out of shape. God would save by an incarnation, God's divine life joined in human flesh, born of a woman. In the stories of Tammuz and Nimrod and Semiramis and in all the ancient myths, you have the death and the resurrection concept. Satan taking the truth and making it serve him, to the literal turnoff of the church world on the total subject. I've preached sermons and done it here. Whatever luxuries in God's book, Satan tries to seize that and twist it out of shape. And again, the deepest privileges of the Christian church and the deepest luxuries that God intends his people to have are taken and by misuse twisted out of shape. Divine healing is such a misuse of the things of God that has been used and misused to the turnoff of God's people until I can remember, and I'm not that old, when to preach on healing was to have you put in a pot with a bunch of exploiters of human suffering that had overpopulated the scene for about a decade. Thank God, the cure for misuse is right use, and truth overpowered the bent out of shape exploiting viewpoint, and the truth of God's not only ability but willingness to heal has permeated every level of the church today. And that truth was rescued. The gifts of the Spirit have always been exploited and been out of shape. Every major revival, I can take the apologetics of the Pentecostal churches where they show that in every age of the church someone was exercising the gifts of the Spirit, and I can show you from the same historical sources that every one of those outbreaks of revival that are bright lights in the Middle Ages ultimately dim because of some fanatical nuts that, like the Corinthian church, can't balance what God's Spirit is doing with God's purposes as revealed in his Word. The Montanists, Tertullian, more responsible than anybody else for the canonization of the New Testament. He brought a revival that had all the gifts of the Spirit. But a bunch of silly women followed him around in idiocy, and the excesses of that band turned the whole community of the church off on the genuine expressions of the Spirit, and that's been true throughout the history. Again, the answer is to rescue the baby from the bathwater. Giving is the same way. I've spent a lifetime preaching that there is absolutely no basis in Scripture for suggesting that God needs our money. He spoke, and not a thing became everything. There can be no possible reason for giving being built into the covenant plan of God except for our benefit. God doesn't need it. There has to be another logic for it. And yet the misuse by offering takers that let the end justify the means and fail to understand that the way you give is more important than what you give, turn people off on it. And if you really want to get the world nervous, you invade the territory of King Dollar. And Jesus said it, the love of money is the root of all evil. There is absolutely nothing that bothers the world quite as much as the money getting away from them and into God's coffers. That bothers them more than anything else. The tragedy is that so much of that which is happening in religious fundraising is light years removed from the biblical basis for doing it. And it opens the door to the criticism. Again, the cure is right use. Communion's another one. If there's any single liturgy of the church that in simplicity was established by Christ and opens the window to the atoning work of Christ and all of its benefits, that simple act in a home of partaking of the elements called the Lord's Supper was given by Christ to keep that window of grace open. Hardly any territory in theology is as battle-scarred as the table of the Lord. Water baptism, another opportunity in simplicity to put us all on one footing. An absolute simple step of faith that anybody anywhere can take in obedience, following our Lord, that ought to bring blessing to the person who does it, became battlegrounds in theology. And early on in the New Testament, the doctrine of grace called forth at least two epistles in the New Testament because of idiots who were beginning to argue that since grace is the outpouring of God's flowing merit to us who do not merit it, He gives us what we don't deserve based on the merit of His Son, and this old world needs all of the grace it can get, and every time sin is forgiven, some grace is being poured out, so let's run around and sin all the more that we can get some more grace poured out so we can improve this world. We just stay sort of ahead of the bucket. If we can sin fast enough to keep the spigot flowing, we'll cover this world with grace. And we become heroes because we're the spigot turners. You know, sin. I testified not too long ago that sin has pleasure for a season. But the New Testament world, and still today, the Christian world has had to contend with Satan grabbing that territory. And if he can't turn grace off, he seeks to turn it on by a caricatured distortion of its truth. I've moved out of those territories, which are familiar, in the last year and a half to subjects that, because so much of the church world has lacked the guts to tackle it and seek for truth for fear they'd knock God off His throne, it's just been turned over to the devil, given to him. All genuine truth will either raise the question that only God can answer or will illustrate the truth of God. And I simply refuse to yield the territory to the devil. I can take every criteria of numbers in the Bible, the days of Balaam that were heaped upon the children of Israel, the 10 tribes to the north. I can take every criteria in the Bible of the time that they should be revealed again, and I come to the turn of the century called 1800, and history backs it up. That's when the evidence suddenly began to spring forth on the stage of history for the rediscovery of the lost tribes. Because the British Israelites grabbed that truth in its early days and bent it out of shape and caricatured it, and because Satan had some people on the scene to grab a surfboard and ride on it and act like monkeys, and one of their voices was recommending every single Britisher change his name to an Israeli or Hebrew name, and one of them changed his name, sent a message to the King of England declaring the day that he must give his crown to him. And they committed him to an insane asylum, which is what they should have done. And Satan accomplished the purpose. Every time you try to get on this truth, people don't argue the facts, they argue the man. Oh, British Israelite. They passed a test in some simple-minded Bible school somewhere on the chaos of cults. The only chaos I encounter in that book is the writing of it itself. I mean, you don't do anybody any good. Nobody's saved from a cult if you caricature their cult. When you caricature the cult, all you do is tell the little closed-minded people that aren't a member of it how great they are that they don't belong to it. That accomplishes nothing. They're already saved. So how in the world are you saving somebody by telling them that they shouldn't be part of something by caricaturing it so bad that they'll say, thank God I never was a part of that. The people that belong to it are never going to be led out of darkness until you honestly define the darkness they're in. I'm not motivated to listen to anybody who caricatures me. And I don't think anybody else is. The evangelical world's run around building straw men that don't exist so they can tear them down. No cult that attracts intelligent people is as simple-mindedly stupid as some people would have you believe. And most cults have a germ of truth that's been bent out of shape and elevated above everything else or totally twisted. I'm not a pro-cultist, though I'm going to fight for everybody's freedom to believe what they want to believe and practice it within the law. I feel sorry for the cultists that are forever put down by people that have not even taken the trouble to understand their position. The truth of the possible connection between the Celtic nations and the lost tribes of Israel is long overdue to be rescued. And I can go on, but then it'd be so late we can't go to the stars. The pyramid, God's monument and testimony that will let God, in the time of the end, point to it and say, I told you so. If you say you never heard the gospel preached, I put it in stone. And Satan has caricatured the pyramid until hosts of people have grown up in the church and do not even know any of the truths contained therein. You know what? If some belly-aching Christians that are scared to death that evolutionary teaching is going to wipe God off his throne and Christianity off the face of the earth, if they would spend exactly 3 months teaching their kids on the pyramid, evolution would fall on deaf ears. Because anybody knows that somebody so much smarter than anybody that's ever lived in this earth to date built it, we could not have evolved, we've been going downhill. And that's what the Bible teaches. Truth is not something to be afraid of. And I've heard people, but by the same token, the devil soared into the pyramid. The fellow we can thank more than anybody else for its knowledge being turned loose on the world is Napoleon, more than anybody else. By the way, in case you think I don't remember things, I still remember we were digging a trench in the Sahara Desert. Remember that? And suddenly there was something. And I haven't told you what that something was yet, have I? Well, I still remember what was there. And we're going to get on with the digging of that trench. But not right now. I also remember that there is, in the study of the lost tribes, the answer to why the ace is the most valuable card in the deck. I mean, there are not many preachers that poker players could listen to and be enlightened. You want to know why the ace is the highest card in the deck? Just keep listening. And we have, at least you've got to give me credit. I began to explain to you why those stupid women eels swam so far to get away from their men for 2 years. Right? So I finished a few things. Of course, there's another side to that. Those men eels that swam all the way from the seaweed sea And they may have just had enough and drove them up those rivers for a while and said, stay away for 2 years and don't come back. So it was two sides to every story, you know. I explained about the one-eyed Pasha. I finished a lot of things. But we have a few things yet to finish. Quite a few. The pyramid, Napoleon, we got to thank with his scholars as well as soldiers that he took there. And when he had to surrender to the British, what Napoleon had uncovered became the basis of the great collection of Egyptian antiquities in the British Museum. Likewise, I've heard preachers not only preach about the pyramid as instruments of Satan. In fact, I read the other day, or heard somebody else tell me that they had read, that somebody had figured out that herpes came from King Tut's tomb. I mean, that's sinking pretty low. Everybody's been scared of the subject, and yet it's God's witness in stone. And I'm going to tell you again, that pyramid is God's monument at the center and at the border of Egypt, not a religious television station. Astrology's got worse treatment. The stars, Satan's handiwork. Astrology's of the devil. Could be. I'm not arguing with that. But what I argue with is because the devil... What's the point I'm making? If it's important to God and to God's people, Satan moves in. And he does his homework so much better than most of God's preachers that he wins every time. He turns the church world off on what God intended to be heard. And we all end up in our little pabulum camp. God so loved the world, gave his only begotten Son, and never even stopped to think, what does he mean by begotten, by the way? Well, I just like to keep it simple. Thank God that he didn't settle for simpletons. And the stars have been looked at as a subject that Christians should steer clear from. Romans 2, I'm back to that. Romans 2:18. I am not, start of the 16th verse, I'm not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God unto salvation. To everyone that believeth, for therein, in the gospel of Christ, for therein is the righteousness of God revealed. I have a translation of the New Testament that has only one contribution to make to the multitudinous translations of New Testaments. Its sole contribution is called the definite article New Testament. You know the difference between a definite article and an indefinite article. An indefinite article leaves some options. There can only be the one of something. The Greek has definite articles in places that English doesn't have it. For example, you can never understand the Philippian letter fully and understand what caused Paul to write the joy letter unless you understand the English simply cannot say, its grammar will not allow it, what Paul said in the Greek. He says, I rejoice and have rejoiced continually and am always rejoicing with and about you Philippians because of your never ceasing, continuous, joint participation with me in the gospel from the very first until the now. We never say the now. We don't put definite articles on words like that. But the Greek does. Because in the midst of all the nows of ongoing experience, by putting the Greek definite article there, an event in the now of the circumstance when he was writing is suddenly lifted out of the matrix and elevated. What is the now? I never cease to rejoice and give praise and continuously be thankful with and for you because of your joint participation with me from the very beginning until the now. Not just from the very beginning until now, which is sort of a long string of things up to the moment, but it embraces the long string of things, including the particularity of the thing that is happening right now. What was the thing that's happening right now? Epaphroditus journeyed all the way from Philippi to bring him an offering. He's in jail, he can't even spend the money. But he's rejoicing because they never cease for 11 years to keep sending it to him. When he closes the letter, he'll say, at the very first, when nobody else would help me, you did when I went to preach in Thessalonica. You helped me. I don't need the gift, even the one that is the now. I don't need it. How could he spend it in jail? But fruit eternally is to your account, and God takes it as a sweet savor offering, and you did right. Now, that definite article at the opening pinpoints the now of what the is that singles it out. You can't understand the opening of John's Gospel without understanding the difference in those articles. We read, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us. The Greek has it, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with the God, and the Word was God. Very subtle, but very important. He did not say, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with the God, and the Word was the God. He drops the definite article at the key point. Let me say it again. He did not say, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with the God, and the Word was the God. That isn't what he said. What he said was, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with the God, and the Word was, and there's no the there, was not. It doesn't say was the God, and the Word was God. Subtle but very important. Not the God, but of the same essence as the God, in that sense, was God also, but not the God. Now, don't lay some Trinitarian stuff on me. Nobody understands that. Anybody tells you you do, they do is crazy. You cannot embrace the Trinity in the English language. It is a declaration of faith that is saying what Paul said when he said, we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face. We'll understand it better by and by. But down here, we're like the blind men. We see the trunk and the legs, and we don't see the elephant. And we talk in the terms that are revealed, the trunk and the legs, and by faith we leave elephantness to that time we get over there. But the revelation of His Word, the definite articles, guide us. I got a whole New Testament that concentrates on the importance of when the definite article is used and when it is not used. Here's a key point. You say, well, this is why I'm doing this. I'm not ashamed of the gospel of Christ. There's only one. For it is the power of God unto dynamite, really, of God unto salvation, dunamis, to everyone that believeth. For therein is the righteousness of God revealed. Not in the exclusive sense, as though that's the only righteousness of God to be revealed. God's righteousness has manifold revelation. As Peter would once say, temptation is multicolored like a spectrum cuts the colors. And then he says, grace is equally manifold in its colors. God's righteousness has diversity of expression. The law was a revelation of God's righteousness, but it couldn't do anything for us. The law is a revelation of God's righteousness. It was like a mirror hung up that could only tell us our shortfalling. But there is a revelation of God's righteousness in the gospel of Christ, which is dynamite. It is power of God unto salvation that works not in performance up to the mirror of the standard, but it works faith to faith. And having said that, which is the whole subject of Romans, I started teaching it some year or so ago, and I'll pick it up again one of these days. I never really got much past the fourth chapter on this time around, though I've preached through Romans many, many times. And like Hebrews, it'll take me 5 years to get through it. If I go back to going through it verse by verse. But he then goes on and says, the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold the truth in unrighteousness. Now, we were on this when I started the stars. The casual reader that reads the Bible through in 52, 62, 72, and 82 thinks that means this. God's wrath pouring out of heaven to burn up Gog and Magog, or to descend in the battle of Armageddon to destroy. That's not what it says. The wrath of God is not pouring out, existentially being realized. It hadn't happened yet. This was written 1900 years ago and it still hasn't happened. The wrath of God has not, in the sense of being realized, been revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men. It hasn't been poured out. If by that verse you mean the wrath of God coming down on ungodliness, it hasn't happened. Hezekiah is still right. The righteous people suffer and the unrighteous people just sail on high places. Yet Paul says in past tense that the wrath has been revealed from heaven. Now, traditionally, if you believe that that means the wrath coming out of the heavens to burn it up down here, then Paul is stating in the past tense something that hasn't happened. That isn't what he meant. He never meant poured out. He meant exactly what he said. Seen, revealed, taught, disclosed, there to be seen, not yet fully executed, but therein revealed. The wrath of God is revealed where? From heaven. He's getting ready to talk about Jews or Gentiles, heathen that never had the law. He's going to say, they're still without excuse. God has always told his story that the wrath of God one day actually will come on all ungodliness, but the revelation of that happening has always been there. Where? In the heavens. The wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold the truth in unrighteousness. Because that which may be known of God is manifest, shown forth. Where? That which may be known of God is manifest. How many of you have in the margin, instead of in them, to them? Only the contest can determine which is right. That which may be known of God, you can meet God, you can listen to His revelation, you can listen to the prophets, and He tells the story and puts all the punctuation in right here. No punctuation in the literal sense, but the full unfolding of God's plan for the ages is revealed through an oracle people in His written word. And as the theologians say, the eternal word became the living word to become the spoken word, to become the preached and written word, to become the engrafted word as we feed on this truth. But God was not limited to this message. Don't come around, Paul is saying, and say to me, well, if you didn't find this message, you never had an excuse, you never had a chance. Oh, yeah. God has always been speaking, and this wasn't His only message. This is the message by which every other message is checked. But the other message was there too. Because from the creation, God was revealing the wrath of God against ungodliness. That which may be known of God is manifest to them, for God has showed it unto them. They never ever listened to Abraham. They never ever listened to Moses. They never met a Jew. They never heard a prophet. And yet God showed it to them. Where? From heaven. For the invisible things of Him from the creation of the world are clearly not experienced in the sense that He poured it out. Seen. Clearly seen. Being understood by the things that are made. He spoke by His creation so that they are without excuse. It was there to be seen. Because that when they knew God, they glorified Him not as God. Neither were thankful, but became vain in their imaginations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools, and they changed the glory of the uncorruptible God into an image made like to corruptible man, and to birds, and four-footed beasts, and creeping things. Wherefore God also gave them up to uncleanness through the lust of their own hearts, desires that is, to dishonor their own bodies between themselves, who changed the truth of God into a lie. Well, now that means that we ought to go behind the lie and find the truth. Who changed the truth of God into a lie and worshiped and served the Creator more than the who worshiped and served the creature more than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. And that's exactly what they did. Nobody can ever tell you where the constellations begin. There is one universal language. Doesn't matter whether you're in South America, Antarctica. Doesn't matter whether you are in Asia. It doesn't matter how far you go back in history. You cannot find. Now, the Bible tells us that the descendants, not the Bible, but the apocryphal books, that the descendants of Seth did it. Enoch is credited. As many credit Enoch as the genius architect or superintendent, one or the other, to whom God gave the plan of the pyramid. So don't believe any of that stuff. But you still got to wrestle with the fact. Here in the Old Testament, they quote the book of Jasher. You still got to wrestle with the fact that nowhere will you find anywhere in the Bible about Christ coming with 10,000 of His saints. Jude is quoting the book of Enoch. He's not quoting Isaac. He's quoting Enoch. He's not even quoting Isaiah. He's quoting Enoch. The book of Enoch. Whether that be true or not, history cannot tell you who or which culture first named these constellations. The earth goes around the sun 365 days and a quarter. As I go around this camera, if I walk around it, when I'm standing over there, I will sight in my mother and dad. And I'm in a room that is got walls that are surrounding me. And if I drew a line through the center of that wall, it would be the equator of the wall. And I'm going around the circle, but I'm going around the sun, which is that camera. And at any given moment, as I sight from where I am through that camera, I will be looking at a different section of the wall as I go around this camera. And during the process of the whole year, as I go around the camera, I will not only go around the camera, but if I sight through the camera, I will be looking at a different section of this wall. And that is the wall of the heavens, where the stars are seen. And because of a tilt and a wobbling on the axes as I spin, at different times I will see stars as I look through the camera, which is the sun, a little below that equator center of the room. At other times I'll be at a position where I'll see stars a little above. Those are the constellations. And from earliest, remotest antiquity, and nobody knows who first started it, in the central band of this room, we could paint 12 constellations or star signs of different magnitude, and nobody knows when they begin to connect the stars with irrational lines that were designs of creatures. The stars were there. Somebody in remotest time connected the stars. There's no possible logic. Astronomers pull their hair out. But it's always been that the stars, as you connect the lines and the constellations, show different shaped beings, animals, creatures, human beings. And as you go around the year, you'll go through 12 of these star signs called the zodiac that are in the center of the equator of the room that we're revolving in. And on one side or the other of that equator, with each of the 12 star groups, will be three companion star groups, making a total of 48, 12 with three each, 4 times 12, the main one on the equator and three companion constellations. You have 48. It's always been that way. And most mythology takes those figures and does exactly what Paul said. They change the glory of God into an image that communicates some earlier meaning, and then they begin to worship the creature instead of the Creator, and change the truth of God that was always there in the heavens declaring the glory of God. They change it into a lie. And because of the lie, man has run from the truth. But Paul is saying, all mankind is inexcusable because God revealed His master plan and the wrath of God against ungodliness from heaven, from the beginning. And that is the truth called the glory of the stars that we are looking at. Now, I stopped long enough to find out if you're there. I'm not about to go into Aries. We've already gone. These 12 zodiacs break into three groups. The first, and there are 4 zodiacal sections each. The first 4 will reveal the mission and the message of the Deliverer, the nature and ministry of the person of Christ. The next 4 speak of the beneficiaries of His mission, and we're in the middle of that, and we're about to the 4th one of it. And the last section deals with His conquering, victorious fulfillment of that revelation of God's glory and the wrath of God against ungodliness. We are into the 4th section of the 2nd great group, Aries, and we've made the trip through the others, and I don't want to have to spend all night reviewing it, and I'd like to know that you're there. Well, I can go home and read it myself.